All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah, we got a very good show for you today. And think about it, the world we're living in today. Think about what's going on in front of our faces right now. In the new year, let's fight for a whole new world together. At the back end of today's show, we're going to be listening to a very special Christmas treat. It's one that I had sworn I was going to run every Christmas, but far too many times I've forgotten it, and I'm going to have to make sure I continue to run it each year because I think it's really what Christmas deserves, okay? And that is, we'll be talking with Stephanie Myers, the editor of a book called The Atheist's Guide to Christmas. And we'll be talking with Paul Krassner, one of the founders and the initiators of the whole Yippie movement back in the 1960s. And he's literally one of the people that helped create the movement that was one of the most rebellious periods of American history. Before that, you'll hear an interview I did with Sansara Taylor, and we're going to be talking about fascism and what's going on now, what's happening now, what needs to be done, and what's going to happen. That's right, what difference will this make? But before we do that, I'm really pleased to be bringing to you the voice of Bird Milliken, and she's an activist from Pennsylvania who infiltrated Trump's Nazi-style rally in Hershey, Pennsylvania on December 10th. You may have seen the pictures in the news, and we had a chance to talk with her. And she chanted out now and gave the orange fascist the finger, all right? And that went all over the world. So without any further ado, check this out. Just a little while ago, someone came up to me and said, hey, you've got to check out what this person is doing. And they started talking to me about, you know, someone named Bird, who was a protester. They told me to look at something. They sent me somewhere to look up a little phrase that Bird had made. The phrase was, when you've got the attention of hashtag real Donald Trump, don't miss your chance to give him the finger. And she said, I still have my sign, and at real Donald Trump received my message. And I'm really pleased to welcome to the show. I have to tell you, it was really just a mind blower. I really thought it was really very, very cool that sentence could be out there for the rest of time. Okay.
Right. And,
yeah, definitely. So I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Bird Milliken. Bird, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this because when I read that statement, you did sort of stuff things right in front of Donald Trump. Tell people what you actually did and where and what.
Well, most recently, Trump came to Hershey, Pennsylvania for a rally. And I went to the rally with the intention of disrupting it, which I did. But ultimately, at the time and the moment, what I did was I had a hat that I had, you know, a middle finger that said his name on it, Trump. It also said hashtag me too on my hat that was inside, that I had inside out. I had a shirt that I had written on the front, grabbing power back, with two middle fingers like over each of my breasts. And on my arms, it said hashtag me too. And on the back, it said refusefascism.org with a really large finger of Donald Trump. Then I held a sign, double-sided. I had a sign that I had. It was double-sided. It said, grabbing power back, with a big middle finger with Trump's name on it. But ultimately, so when I started holding up the sign and screaming, Trump Pence out now, ultimately I ended up in this, like, area on the right of the stage that was partitioned off where there was no security or anybody. It wasn't my intention to necessarily get into that little partitioned off area. I think I was trying to remove myself from the pit, and that's kind of where I was corralled into. And then security didn't seem to know how to get me out. So I was walking around for a pretty good amount of time with my sign and giving the finger to Trump. And I swear I had a moment with him where, and I don't know if this was captured in the media, or how long it was, where I stood there for a decent amount of time, just holding my hand up and just making eye contact with him, giving him the finger. And I'm pretty sure there was a moment of recognition, because I actually disrupted his rally in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania in August of 2018, where I did something similar. And I feel like there was a moment of recognition where he thought, oh, man, I remember this. I remember this woman now. Yeah, I think that's part of why his response to me was why he was so upset about me doing what I did, and why he encouraged the security to not be DC with me and getting me out of there. So it was kind of surreal how much the anger that I provoked from him. I can't say I'm surprised at all, but it was a very surreal moment, and I'm so grateful that no one hurt me physically. And so that was a positive thing. But it's not. But so it wasn't my first time doing that. And it went over really well in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, because you've mentioned this a couple of times, and I'm really fascinated about this. You know, why did you decide to make such a bold move, especially by yourself?
I felt compelled into action. I feel like when there's certain injustices or egregious things happening, that it kind of baffles me that others don't feel similar the way I do similarly. And I felt like a statement needed to be made. Now, the goal and intent was that this time around, I wasn't going to be alone. But because it was such a mess leading up to it, it ended up where I was alone again, which at the end of the day, you know, I'm okay with. I've done some pretty outspoken things on my own before my work against Trump, especially regarding the Bill Cosby trials. I've done a lot of things. I think at the end of the day, too, I'm not governed by other people's judgments of me. I think how some people are. I think some people are more worried about how they'll be perceived or the backlash, because you definitely get that. I think it's hard for me to just stand by and feel like I'm not doing all I can to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing, and this is in connection with what you had spoken a little bit about earlier, about what it was like to wait and get inside, because you're standing inside this big arena, and it's filled with people who are Trumpites. And I wanted to ask you, like, you know, how you did what you did, and how did it feel, including the fact that you're standing in the middle of this whole, you know, just like terrible, rotten soup of Trump supporters,
right?
You know?
Well, let me say this. Prior to getting in, there was this ginormous long line outside. I took some videos and pictures of things outside, but the line outside was rather insane. I mean, it was so long and zigzag back and forth. I mean, I can't even express how bad it was, how long this line was. So at around 5:50, everybody's still standing in this line. You know, I can't even tell you how far back we are out, and I am out there. And everyone starts bugging out, like, are we getting in? Are we going to be, you know, because it wasn't moving that fast. All of a sudden, the entire line collapsed, and everyone started rushing forward in this big mass. And let me tell you, my colon almost fell out of my body at that moment, because I was like, dear God, how is anyone going to get in now? Because people have been standing in this line for hours, and now, you know, everyone's rushing forward. I mean, it was like this moment of like, holy crow, like this, like I thought my, like, I'm never getting in there now. The universe was on my side because I was able to weasel. I think being alone helped in that way, me like weaseling my way all the way up into the front as best as I could, you know, to get actually in. So getting inside, it was just so unnerving. It's interesting, too, when I was at the Wilkes-Barre rally, when I was waiting to get in line, I was actually interviewed by a British journalist who asked me, you know, why I was there. And it was really hard to kind of to not blow my cover. But being there this week, it's surreal and unnerving. And I knew the whole time that, like, I'm about to piss off 10,000 people. and that's a surreal feeling to know that, like, within moments, all these people are going to be really angry at you. I think when you do certain acts of activism, it's good. The more information you have about what you're doing and how you're going to go about it, the less anxiety-provoking, and you can kind of stay on task. So it was important to me to kind of have a plan of what I was going to do and have a certain strategies of like what I can do to decrease the odds of being pummeled by these people. But hearing everybody chanting together and responding to him or just getting riled up, especially with some of the things that are said, I mean, it is really, really, really unnerving. And then there's certain things you can't help but notice, that the vast overwhelming majority of the people are white and male. So it's interesting when you hear Trump speak. He speaks about all the good that he's doing for our nation. It's like, it's interesting because the demographics of who's there don't really represent our nation. So it's like, well, how come just these people are happy with you? Where are all the rest of the people in Pennsylvania who aren't reflected here? So it's an unnerving, surreal experience. But honestly, when I hear that chanting and stuff, after getting past the horror of it, my next thought is, and this is why I'm here. And this is exactly why I need to be here, because of this. And that's why I have to do what I'm about to do, because of this. In some ways, it's more of a driving force versus a deterrent. Yeah. And I think, too, like when you stand for something bigger than yourself, life is a little bit more meaningful when you're working towards something that's bigger than, oh, am I going to get to Target on time today, you know? I'll tell you what, I'm still not exactly grounded from it all. It's definitely unnerving because I'm still getting a lot of backlash online. You know, that's unnerving, but again, it also fuels me, so.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Bird Milliken, who recently disrupted, not once, but let me pursue that a little bit, because I think I really did like the way that you didn't cater or kowtow to this whole, you're in the middle of like, you know, I think when I was a kid and I used to watch these like rodeo things, and you had all these, this massive crowd of people who were doing, then who were there watching all this, and then I started thinking about, okay, then you have the reflection on what did the Germans do, what did it look like when Hitler was holding all these massive, you know, rallies and stuff, and what it was bringing together. There's a pull, I'm sure, when you're there by yourself, you're in the midst of this howling mob, and you didn't cater or kowtow to them. And I think it's really important that that actually is the stand you took, because you were pretty much on your own. I watched them taking you out and stuff, and you were, and even as they're trying to pull you out or trying to walk you out, there wasn't one moment where you stopped and said, okay, let's go. You actually continued to hold up your banner, hold up all this other stuff, and to really make the point that you wanted to make. And I thought that was extremely important and something that people should learn from.
Well, I appreciate that. Oh, I thought at the time of the moment, I think this is my chance. If you're going to do it and get attention. I wasn't there to kind of like be fleeting. And I think I'm aware, too, of how fleeting media exposure can be. So I might be thinking I'm in the right time and place and that whoever can see me or my sign, but that might not necessarily be the case. So it was important to me that I was as bold and as big and made as big of a statement as I could while I was there. Before going in, I definitely, you know, prayed and was meditating leading up to it and kind of calling the powers of good onto my side and to protect me and have my back. The fact that I was able to get into that large area where there was zero security, again, I feel like the universe was on my side for that to allow that to happen for me.
You know, the other thing though that's on your side too is that you really do have a lot of determination and a lot of guts to be standing out there and saying, look, this is just fundamentally wrong what's being done here, and it's something that I have to stand up for. And I would imagine there's some impact of not just you standing up, but the impact you hope that it has on a wider audience. Let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, most of my activism work, it's not about me. I'm not looking for attention personally. In an ideal world, my behavior would inspire others to get involved or to do something or to join me. I'd be happy to follow them as well into the fire. But that's the whole plan. And it's rather amazing when my actions that are like that don't inspire others. Because again, I did something just like this in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. But the plan, like I said, was that there'd be a couple other people with me, but ultimately they weren't able to get inside. But even so, you know, ideally I'd be like just the drop in the ocean that begins the wave. So I'm hoping that my actions will encourage others to join me. Now, one of the things I've been working on since the other night was I'm actually writing up a kind of how-to manual on, like, how to infiltrate a place like this. So, like, kind of tactics, things that I did to make it more accessible to others. I'm hoping maybe if I write things down and walk people through certain things, then they'll feel like, okay, well, maybe this is something I can wrap my head around or actually engage in or do. Because I think it's important, you know, for protests to be outside and whatever, but my goal was to actually cause a disruption, to interfere, to infiltrate, really. As dangerous as that may be, I feel like it's also effective in getting media exposure. You're more guaranteed to get that kind of exposure if you do it right then and there and put yourself in the midst of it all than maybe waiting patiently for someone to turn their camera your way. So I hope, like I said, once I finish writing this up, which will hopefully be today, and get this out there, it'll make things more accessible to others in the future going forward.
Mm-hmm. You talked about why you did this, and you know, I wanted to pursue that a little bit more, because in terms of this, how did you view the crowd that actually came there to support him? You know, like, I got to say, when somebody told me that you walked into this crowd and you found yourself in this, and I read the piece that said you found yourself in this like open place where you could be so close to where this monster is, but you're surrounded by tens of thousands of people, and those people have come to see him. And I wondered at that moment, what did you think? What do you think of the crowd that actually comes in to see Trump in relation to what you're doing?
I personally pity them, or I feel for them. I personally feel like you can't be in a good place and be one of his supporters. So those who are there, I guess I kind of view as injured or wounded folks, whether they know it or not. But I feel that. Even just the hostility. I mean, you have a lot of that kind of anger. It feels very mobby in a way that feels like on the hinge of danger, not very off of like a KKK type of feeling. Not that I have any idea what that would feel like. But I guess I view these people as folks who are doing the best they can with what they know, and they're misguided. Or their exposure in life, their experiences have not been like mine. In social work, I'm actually a social worker as well. One of the phrases we say is meet people where they're at. And I feel like a lot of these people, they're on board with his message. They're on board with where he's coming from. So that says a lot with where they're at, which to me is a sad place. Now, if I were to talk to probably the vast majority of them, they would probably say all this about me, that I'm misguided and all that. But it's very clear to me the sickness or pain that exists within that community, and the amount of potential to cause harm to others. I feel compelled to stand up within it, even so, because ultimately I viewed it as an opportunity. It was bigger than that moment. Well, worst case, I get the hell beat out of me. Super worst case, I die. But at least I'm assuming it would be captured on video, and maybe that'll make a difference somewhere. Now, maybe it won't, but it certainly increases the odds of making a difference than if I were to stay at home and do nothing and allow him to speak uninterrupted. But I feel like, you know, when we look at Hong Kong, it's like people need to take to the streets, in my opinion. People need to, like, physically disrupt and to get out there and rattle things up, because going along with the process or waiting for certain things to happen, a lot of things are getting worse and more dangerous, and the stakes are getting higher for people. And I guess I feel like enough's enough. Like, what are we waiting for? Like, there's power in mobilizing and just interfering with things. There's a lot that can happen from that. Again, like, you look at Hong Kong, like, they're getting it done. They're getting it done. The people have spoken. They got out there. They raised hell. And there's no reason why Americans can't do the same thing, demand something bigger, better, different. And I think we should, in so many regards, we should demand something better than where we're at, especially when you hear a Trump rally. It's like everything he says, and you're just hearing people agreeing with him. It's like, how are other people not disrupting this moment? But like I said, hopefully this will inspire others to actually go inside and make a difference. But I think there are tactics you can use to decrease the odds that you're going to get yourself pummeled. But there's no guarantee. You know, it's a risk. It's a risk. But to me, it felt like that I had to do that. You know, when I'm off this earth physically, I want people to say, well, man, she tried. She tried her best to make a difference and to take a stand. And she did everything in her power. Okay, maybe not everything, because there's always more I could be doing. But she sure as hell tried. I want that to be my legacy, that I didn't go along with things. I was willing to put myself on the line for something bigger.
That's an extremely important legacy, and one that I think a whole hell of a lot more people should be thinking about. But, Bird, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, Michael, if you don't mind, one thing I'd like to mention is, sure, I've been doing some work with Refuse Fascism, and this weekend is a big weekend. On December 14th, we're having protests all across the nation. There's one in L.A. that's happening at 4 o'clock, in MacArthur Park, 2 o'clock on Saturday at Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. So if you go to refusefascism.org, you can print out posters from there and also find out event details, but you can get involved. And hopefully this manual that I've been talking about on the how-to will be reflected at some point to social media. Michael, thank you for this opportunity to share this with you.
Yeah, sure. And let's stay in touch. Thanks.
Take care.
All right, Bird.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of 12 dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard, and it's hard. And it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard. It's a hard rain's gonna fall.
All right, you've just been listening to an interview I had just the other day with Bird Milliken, an activist from Pennsylvania who infiltrated Trump's Nazi-style rally in Hershey, Pennsylvania on December 10th, chanted "Out Now," and gave the orange fascist the finger. Yeah, just imagine about 10 million people doing that right now and doing that and just really stepping up and doing what's necessary today, folks. And joining us to talk about this right now is Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for RevCom.us, advocate for the new communism forged by Bob Avakian, and working with RefuseFascism.org to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, you too. It's been a long time. It's been way too long, okay? So we'll have to change that later. Fascism, it's in power. Continues to unfold and spread, and there's a need for a lot more resistance. What's the situation now?
Well, I, first of all, I was really moved by the interview that we just heard with Bird Milliken, and I have to give her a shout out for her courage and for the standard that she set, you know, at the end of what she said about we all have to think about how we're going to be remembered and what our lives are going to count for in this time, to speak to your question, when fascism is in power. In the United States of America, the only superpower on the planet, and it is rapidly advancing a program of absolute horrors for humanity. I'm talking about the Trump-Pence regime. I know everybody thinks they know, okay? People think, oh, I know. People talk about Trump. I'm sick of hearing about Trump. You think you know, but you have no idea. People, we're living in a time, and you've learned over the years, the last 3 years, to get acclimated and normalized to this fascism in power. It means children in concentration camps. It means they're lifting the ban. They're moving right now to lift the ban on indefinite detention of children and families in these camps, in concentration camps. We see the largest military budget ever passed in the history of this country just went through bipartisan. Because even as the Democrats are moving forward with impeachment, on the one side, they're rallying and promising the world that you can work with this fascist Trump, and they're going to be bipartisan and find common ground. And they're influencing people in this country to think, okay, Trump's bad, but we can work with it. We can make it through. And meanwhile, the laws of this country, the culture in this society, the people in this society, and its impact on the world are being radically remade in a very nightmarish direction. It's the assault on immigrants, it's the open white supremacy, it's the hunting and unleashing mass shooters against immigrants and Jewish people, it's the packing the courts with Christian fascist fanatical judges, ripping up women's right to abortion and even birth control, taking away LGBTQ rights. These things will be locked in for generations. It's the shredding of environmental protections, clean water, clean air, pulling out of the Paris Accord. This is pouring gasoline on the burning fires of climate change at a time when we are reaching a tipping point and the future of human civilization literally all over the world is on the line. And we have a lunatic, a science denier, a fascist bigot in the White House and a whole regime cohered around that. And this is moving rapidly. And so this is on the one hand, and on the other side, you have people who don't like this. I know your listeners. I know the people listening to my voice right now. Most of you are sickened by what's happening, but let's be honest. Most people have learned to live with this and are tending to their own gardens and their own lives and hoping it goes away through the normal course of things. And this is a deadly delusion that we have to disrupt. And this is what Refuse Fascism and the Out Now movement is fighting for people to confront and to join us in the streets this Saturday to say out now, but also going forward. Because all over the world, people are showing you we have the power to remove a fascist regime. All over the world, people are in the streets. They're driving out hated regimes. They're coming back day after day. Bird was just talking about the struggle in Hong Kong, which is complicated because they are getting support and influence by the U.S. There's a lot of complexity there, but there's a courageous stand being modeled in many places around the world. And people in this country, we got to get out of our comfort zone. We got to put something on the line. We have to stop this fascism before it is too late. And we are getting dangerously close to too late. So this is a struggle for this Saturday, but then to go forward from there in sustained, that is repeated, mass nonviolent protests until we win our demand that this regime must go.
Yeah, you know, I'm listening to you talk. It's sort of I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, you know, there really is a situation that I think a lot of people don't even consider. And I think you spoke to this, that the reality is that things, it can become too late. And without looking at what needs to be done, I think it is true. A lot of people have this thing of I don't like Trump. I don't. Yeah, of course, I don't like fascism. But, you know, I'll do whatever. I'll vote next year. Or I'll do this or I'll do that. And you look at the response that Trump was making to where things are at now with the impeachment and his, I was just hearing it on the news coming over here, you know, this whole sort of this just over the top arrogance of like, they're not going to do anything. We got, and they're making it clear. They're not going to, you know, no matter what, there's always this sort of overhanging thing of like, it's not going to make a bit of difference, even if it was serious. And I wanted to ask you that real quick. What do you think actually really needs to be done today?
Well, you mentioned the impeachment, and I just want to say there's two forces fighting in this impeachment. There's the fascists, there's Trump and his side, who are declaring war on the whole process. I mean, they are obstructing justice, they are abusing power, they are saying that there is that the supposedly co-equal branch of government cannot do oversight and they're above the law. This is what Trump is saying. He's ordered people not to testify. He's ordered people not to turn over documents. He's at every step he's declaring this illegitimate and defying it. So on the one hand, you have him ramping up the fascism, but you have the Democrats are fighting to constrain him, but on very narrow grounds. Not bringing in his whole fascist program, not bringing in the children in the camps, not bringing in the Christian fascist theocracy, not bringing in, keeping it on national interest, national security interests. So they're fighting on ruling class interests, not on the interests of the people. They have a big beef with Trump. They have big differences with Trump, but they're fighting it out. These are two ruling class parties fighting each other over how to rule the empire. And let's be honest, the Democratic Party is a party of war crimes. It's a machinery of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The Republicans are fascists, but the Democrats are a party of war crimes. And you see this when they come together. The day that they announced the impeachment articles, they also signed NAFTA. They also with Trump. They also the next day put out this national defense budget with Trump, the biggest military budget in the history of this country. They united with Trump to do this. This is a fight at the top, where the interests of humanity, the interests of the people to see this fascism stopped is not being represented. At the same time, it's an opening if we act, if the people act from below, if we go into the streets, and this gets to what we need to do. We need to stop waiting for the Democrats, stop waiting for the courts, stop waiting for Santa Claus, stop waiting for something else to happen besides us getting out of our comfort zone and going in the streets and raising the single demand that can unite people from very different perspectives. I'm speaking as a communist revolutionary, you could probably tell that, indicting the whole of the ruling class, even while making the distinction that the fascists are qualitatively worse for humanity. But other people, too, who maybe believe in the promise of this country, maybe are supporting a Democratic candidate, hoping that that's part of the equation. We need to come together in the streets to say right now there's an emergency where the people's voice has to be heard from below, seizing on this crisis at the top to force through our demand, which is that this whole regime must go because it's fascist. And there's no other voice, whether you're a communist and a revolutionary like me or you're not. You have to recognize facts as facts. There's no voice in the impeachment halls, in the halls of power, on the debate stage of the Democratic candidates who will call this program out as fascist and is pulling out all the stops to fight for the removal of this regime. That is what's needed, and so we have to do that ourselves, and it can be done. This is why we're going to the streets on Saturday, on the 14th, this Saturday, across the country. But we're also struggling with people. You look at, you know, this rally that Bird Milliken went to, this Trump rally in Pennsylvania on the Refuse Fascism Twitter feed, at Refuse Fascism. You can see video with interviews of the Trump supporters. And they're talking about civil war. They're gearing up for civil war. They're saying, you know, if you remove Trump, I've got my 45 Magnum or whatever level artillery they've got. They're saying that says you won't. They're talking about this openly. And on our side, people are going about checking their Christmas list, their holiday shopping, and picking their kids up from school and acting like this is not happening. And we have to reverse this, where the situation where the worst are filled with passionate intensity. Trump and his fascist base are out there like a lynch mob every day, and the best lack all conviction and are self-absorbed in going along. We know people have a better side. They don't want to see this happen, but we've got to step out there. We've got to confront. Yes, fascism can happen here in America. Of course it can happen here. It's a country founded on slavery. It's a country with mass incarceration. It's a country that has white supremacy built into it. It's a country that shoots and abortion doctors and blows up women's clinics. This is a country, absolutely fascism can happen here, and it is happening here. And we have to cast aside the delusion that somehow there's something special about America that would prevent this. The only thing special about America is it's got a deep history of terror and oppression against people of color, against women, against the people of the world, out of which this fascism is now growing as this system has confronted major crisis in the world. So it is happening here, and we're the ones. Americans are comfortable. We live lives of privilege compared to the rest of the world. So, you know, there's a lot of that comfort that gets in the way. There's a lot of that stability that people here are used to that gets in the way. We have to get out of our comfort zones because the humanity needs this from us. And there is no such thing as painless progress. There is no Santa Claus coming to remove Trump and Pence. We've got to do this, and we have the power to do this. And one of the things I liked so much about listening to Bird just now is that there is a joy. Yes, there's a risk in stepping out. It's not easy to dislodge fascists. They are deadly serious, okay? People in Los Angeles have been put on trial, but they've also won those trials so far. I'm not saying we'll win every trial, but we have each other's backs when we stand up. So, yes, there's risk, but the risk of sitting back and letting this fascism consolidate is far worse. And there is joy, and there is upliftment, and there is a different kind of morality of standing up for the people of the world and putting something, like she said, bigger than ourselves. That's what we need to do. It's very important. We need to get over ourselves, you know, in the selfie culture. We need to think about humanity first and what kind of world we're leaving to future generations and to the children right now who are spending their holiday, literally spending their holiday in cages, not knowing where their parents are. Those are our children. Those are our children, and that's our responsibility. And so we're calling on everybody to join us in the streets. Come out and challenge others to join us, too, and be part of solving this problem. How do we get people over their fear? How do we reverse the dynamic where the Trump supporters, the fascists, are out there passionately, and the people who don't like this are lacking conviction,
right,
are hoping and waiting? We need to work on reversing that together, but that starts by coming out. And we have to have all kinds of people working on this problem. What arguments do we need to make? What actions do we need to take? How do we build this? Because we know I'll just say this. This is, I'm not trying to scold people. That's not why I'm coming at it this way. We know there are tens of millions of people who do not want to live in a fascist America, who do not want to live in a whites-only America, who do not want to live in a world where women are reduced to breeders of children and property of men, and where LGBTQ people are slammed back into the closet and the planet burns and melts. People who don't want that future. And what we're saying is there's a way to get to a world without that. And the road there is to come into the streets and raise the demand. Out now. Trump, Pence, out now. Whatever movement you're part of, if you're not part of any movement, Refuse Fascism is fighting for this, but you don't have to join Refuse Fascism to recognize that we need to drive Trump, Pence out now, and we have that power. So you raise that demand. You come out as who you are. We join together. We learn from each other as we wage this struggle.
All right, Sansara, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And Sansara, thank you very much for bringing all this out to people.
Michael, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. And I want to tell everybody listening one more thing. Michael Slate needs to stay on the air. He's the greatest, I mean, just one of the greatest radio programs you will ever get a chance to hear.
Thanks, Sansara. And I'll talk to you again soon.
Take care.
All right, folks, you've been listening to what should be disturbing and inspiring things that we've brought to you today. You know, people standing up around what is happening. And I think it's important, you know, and why we insist on the Michael Slate Show on exposing the Trump-Pence regime as fascist. You know, it's not, and what Sansara was just talking about, it's not just a label, a bad word, calling somebody a bad name. Fascism is a radical change in the way that this system is run. And getting rid of the rule of law, ending civil liberties and democratic rights, looking at what's going on in the world today, this is time to take this serious. And people who have been listening to the, you know, to basically the impeachment hearings and all this other stuff, and then to see what nobody is ever hiding, that there's a tremendous likelihood that Trump is going to say, screw you, I don't care. They're already saying they don't care. It's almost a given. And think about, what did the Democrats do? Did they come out and did they really hit at the hard hitting, the most important things going on in the world today, in this country? All the things that Sansara talked about? No. They simply talked about one minor little thing, okay? And it's more, you know, it's disgusting. It's sickening the way that this stuff is being allowed to flourish. It is going to be hell. It is going to be hell. Not just for people here, but for the entire world. Think about what's going on. Just think about the kinds of things, you know, that are happening in relation to the climate, what's happening in relation to immigrants. Think about those kids that have been, you know, pushed into prison cells because they're immigrants. Think about what's happening to the oppressed nationalities in this country. Think about how it's become sort of okay. There's never enough protests. There's never enough standing up to people. Millions of people should be standing up every time that a black person or a brown person are killed by the police. Millions of people should be standing up and saying, no, we're not going to allow this to happen. But it's going to take a whole different society for that to become the way things are. Right now, we are sitting in a society that is one of the most horrific societies in the history of the world, okay? The fact that this monster, Trump, has the ability to totally incinerate the vast majority of the world, to turn the planet into ashes, and he is just the person to do it. Sisters and brothers, this is a call to you. You know, look, there are moments in which the fate of humanity itself hangs in the balance, okay? And such times always bring with them a resurrection of ugly myths and ugly people running things. This is the kind of thing, not just ugly for the sense of being ugly, but it's actually people who are doing horrendous things. And they need to be stepped up against. They need to be exposed. They need to be fought. You know, face up what we're up against. Just face it. You know, you don't have to be scared. Just face what we're up against. And you don't have to be scared because there are people out there that are exposing this, that are fighting for this, that are bringing people an understanding of what's happening and why and what can be done about it.
We're going to take a short break and be right back.
Now, a few years ago, I interviewed two people who I think brought a great version of the Christmas spirit to the world. Stephanie Myers, who was the editor of one of my favorite Christmas storybooks, The Atheist Guide to Christmas, was joined in that interview by someone who also had a very special place in my heart. One of the original tormentors of the status quo and one of the people who helped turn the myth of America's promise on its head, rolled up and forever trashed, Paul Krassner. Paul was one of the people who literally shaped the movement that helped create one of the most rebellious periods in American history. Now, this interview was done shortly before Paul died, but it remains as a treasure of Paul's ability to rip open the heart of all that makes America so despicable. And although he's been dead for quite some time now, I have no doubt that he would have loved to continue skewering the American nightmare. This is for you, Paul.
Well, I walked to town in the pouring rain, paid my fare and I rode that train to the station under the avenue, hit the air at the stroke of noon. At the cross streets where I staked my claim, I played in tune with the winter rain, collecting dimes and dollar bills while the noisy traffic played the fills, and it's Christmas time in the city.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Mary Chapin Carpenter with Christmas Time in the City, a really beautiful song. And imagine this. It manages to capture the spirit of the season, and best of all, takes the holy out of holiday. In that spirit, I'm really happy to welcome our next guest to the show. Stephanie Myers is one of the editors of what I found to be one of the more fascinating books of the Christmas season, The Atheist Guide to Christmas. And Paul Krasner is one of the contributors of this, as well as being, and Paul's got a, he has got a, I don't know, I'd say he's got a bio that stretches about a football field long. And he's always been one of the people who I've looked to in the world to kind of look at and understand that there's really, both through satire and through telling the truth, he's really helped a lot of people see what reality is. He's the author of Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture, and he's the recent recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Oakland branch of Penn. So, Stephanie, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Sure. Well, Stephanie, let's jump into it with you first. What the hell got into you to get into this Atheist Guide to Christmas, hmm?
Well, you know, it actually started a couple years ago with the UK Atheist Bus campaign, where UK journalist Ariane Shireen noticed that a lot of Christian organizations were advertising on buses, and she said, you know what, why can't we do that? So she set out to raise a little bit of money and ended up raising £150,000 to do bus advertisements saying, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. So at that point, it just seemed like there was the energy and the excitement to turn something like that into a book with that same sort of attitude. So that's where this came from.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get involved in it?
You know, I am closely in touch with HarperCollins UK colleagues, and so they sent over this project. And being someone who was never raised practicing a religion but who loves Christmas as well as other holidays, I mean, I'm just as excited about Halloween as Christmas, honestly, but it spoke to me, and there were such great contributors signed up and so many different types of essays and so many different ways that people still really enjoyed the holidays despite their religious affiliations or non-affiliations. So I just thought it was such a fun project.
And Paul, how about you? How did you get involved in this?
Stephanie invited me to contribute, and it was for a good cause. Stephanie can talk more about that. And it was an opportunity to see that this is another little evolutionary jump in atheism coming out of the closet. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, I got beaten up for it. It's a sign of progress in that, so I was happy to accept her invitation.
Now, you grew up in New York?
Yes.
Okay, and are you telling me that you expect me to believe that there were gangs of God-filled heathens, or God-filled whatever, hooligans? Not heathens, God-filled hooligans who were beating up heathens?
Well, no. It wasn't a gang. You know, it was just like one or two guys from junior high school.
Oh, okay. Well, I got beat up by a gang of nuns. You know, that was. I also got
really?
Strangled. Yes, I got strangled by the bishop too when I got my confirmation because I asked the question you weren't supposed to ask. Wait a minute. How can you be three gods in one? The bishop actually slapped my face really hard, knocked me off the altar rail, and that sort of marked my exit from Catholicism. So,
huh.
Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah, no, but that's a very nice visual picture, a gang of nuns.
It may be nice to talk about now, but I still have horrible, horrible nightmares about it.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. I mean, as an atheist, I don't have believe in a God to get mad at me. But it is a paradox, Michael, because not only am I an atheist, but I'm also an absurdist. And what could be more absurd than for an atheist to have continuing dialogue with the deity he doesn't believe exists?
And are you saying that you do that?
Oh, sure. You know, like as a stand-up satirist, when I'm in the green room waiting to go on, I'll say, please, God, help me do a good show. And then I'll hear the voice of God say, shut up, you superstitious fool.
Okay, there's so much to unravel about that, Paul. I don't know where to begin.
We're talking with writer and satirist Paul Krassner, one of the contributors to The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and Stephanie Myers, a co-editor of the book.
Stephanie, Paul mentioned the idea that atheists actually, and who knows whether this is absolutely true, but atheists, and I know from my own experience and having been an atheist for a very long time, but also talking with other people around it, and I've talked with P.Z. Myers about this, there's a tendency, not only are atheists, like in this country in particular, really cowled, or there's that idea that they're the most hated minority in the country, but there's really, people are not very aggressive and assertive when it comes to their atheist beliefs. And in Britain and in Europe, it's a little bit of a different story, but you've gotten a number of people from the U.S. to actually contribute to this atheist guide. How did you find doing that? How did you find the people to do that?
You know, it's funny. I was responsible for bringing in more U.S. contributors. And, of course, I had my list of big names. And then I wanted to find more up-and-coming writers. And I was literally just Googling, you know, lists of up-and-coming atheists or, you know, lists of feminist atheists and just trying to find great people who are talking. Like one person, Jennifer McCrate, who blogs at blaghag.com. She's a young grad student. I think she's just brilliant and someone to keep an eye on, so I was really excited about finding that. But I would say I'm someone who's totally guilty of being an in-the-closet atheist, and until I worked on this project, I just hadn't thought about it. It was something that didn't come up in life ever, and so working on this, I've really started to see that there's some point to talking a little bit more about it, and it's been an interesting evolution for me, and I'm excited to bring that to other people, because really it's such a tame-looking book, right? It's a great entryway. If someone isn't feeling aggressive about it and really doesn't want to commit to a longer, more in-depth book, this is a great thing to start off and get a sense of who's writing in this space.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's sort of, yes, the book is, you know, it's got snowflakes on the front. It says The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and you put featuring Richard Dawkins and a number of other people. And then when you open it up, it actually is a lot different than what I expected to find, actually. I mean, I really enjoyed all of the various stories. Now, I'd ask you, leaving aside Paul for a moment, what is one of your favorite stories in here?
I really love Simon Singh's piece, which is about celebrating a different birth, which is the birth of the universe at Christmas. And I think it's a great mixture of good writing and good science. And that's really one of my favorites.
Now, Paul, in your piece, you actually, I mean, it's very interesting because you don't just talk about yourself developing as an atheist, although I found that really fascinating and funny, but I also felt you also did something that was very horrifying, which is, and revealing, when you talked about the title of your piece is There's No Atheist in the White House. Can you talk about some of the things that you revealed in that, which I thought are mind-blowing, because people don't know this stuff about the presidents and their conversations with this non-existent deity?
Yes, well, I did some research because there was so much religious piety coming out of the White House, and my attitude towards believers is not hostile, because whether they use it as a crutch or they believe it sincerely, my turning point was when, because I was more militant then than I am now, but what was my turning point was that Martin Luther King was a Christian, and he was a kind, moral activist, humane. Whereas at the same time, George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the American Nazi Party, called himself an agnostic. So the tipping point for me was to start just relating to people not by what they believed, but how they related to humans and animals and the earth. And so I don't categorize that. And so in my research, but I did believe that people who thought that God actually talked to them were deluded, including George Bush. And then in my research, I found out that his father said the same kind of things, an atheist shouldn't be in the White House, that went back to Lyndon Johnson. You know, it was, and there were others. And there's only one, Abby Hoffman once told me, Abby Hoffman, the late activist and co-founder of the Yippies, started out as another co-founder, Jerry Rubin did, working within the system. And Abby was supporting some candidate in Boston, and somebody asked the candidate about religion, and he said, oh, I'm an atheist. And the reporters started walking out. They said, okay, there goes the ball game. And so currently now, I think Pete Stark is the only, I guess, as you say, openly gay, openly atheistic in the entire legislature. So, and there were laws in some states. In the article, I mentioned specifically in different states where they said that nobody could be a candidate if they didn't profess a belief in God. So it shows the background of the kind of thing that religion and politics are in the same bed together, and you know, and they always had Billy Graham come there, and even when Richard Nixon, one of the tapes revealed, was saying some of his anti-Semitic remark, Billy Graham agreed. You know, and that's as bad as saying itself. I wrote to the Anti-Defamation League about that and never heard back.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how much comes out of the mouths of these God-fearing people. I mean, it's even, you know, you have General Boykin, and you have all the thing that happened in Fallujah where people were, these commanders in Iraq were demanding, you know, as they're committing this horrific slaughter and one of the worst war crimes in the Iraq War in Fallujah, and they're talking about that the face of Satan is in there, and they're going to go in and defeat Satan for God, you know, and it's, I mean, this kind of thing that develops here, it's interesting to me because you have the most, and even with Bush, when you were talking about Bush's father in your article, you actually make the point that George Bush the First actually made the point not just that people shouldn't occupy the White House, but he doesn't know that atheists should be considered citizens.
Well, you know, there was one thing, you mentioned that I got the Penn Lifetime Achievement Award, and so in my speech, I always knew, I made a vow to myself that if I ever got an award like that, this is what I would do. And so I said, you know, you don't get a Lifetime Achievement Award for just doing everything alone. You know, you collaborated with people, you were supported by people and nurtured. And I said, and I would like to thank these people in chronological order, starting with my parents, and who were embarrassed by what I wrote and even ashamed of it. But nevertheless, you know, I was editing The Realist, which was considered by others as the hippest magazine in America, but I was still living with my parents. Okay, so I said, but first and foremost, I don't know about, many of you don't know too much about my spiritual quest. And so, first of all, I would like to thank Satan. And the people who knew me there, you know, laughed. But there were, you know, various book awards, and the people who came for that, they were silent because there was no way to tell that that I wasn't being sincere. And I mean, in fact, I have said to people, you know, when they read it in the San Francisco Chronicle and knew about it, and they asked me about it, and I said, well, you know, it was a tough competition, but I beat out Justin Bieber. And a lot of people said, oh, yeah, yes, and he's only 14. I said, yes, but he's writing his memoir.
Okay, all right, that's a good one there. We're talking with Stephanie Myers, one of the co-editors of The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and to writer and satirist Paul Krassner, one of the contributors to this anthology. Paul, just one more quick question for you at the moment is, you know, Stephanie talked about her own sort of being reticent about coming out with her atheism. You actually became an atheist in a way. Becoming an atheist actually introduced you to a whole other world of, it seemed, in what you described in the article. It really was a sort of a process that brought you into a whole other social world that really seemed to have an effect on shaping the rest of your life.
That's true. You know, it was a religious experience. That's the irony of it. I had been, because you can see, trace the chain of events that led you to it. But I started out in college in a philosophy course. I had to do a paper, and I wanted to do one on a dialogue between Plato and an atheist. And just on a whim, I looked up atheism in the telephone book, and there it was. You know, they put the word that you're looking up left. So it was Atheist American Association of, 4 A's. And I found that I went to a little office there, and they were met the editor of their paper, The Truth Seeker, which later became an anti-Semitic hate rag, when he died, they got a different editor. But they had an ism forum, which was to talk about all the different isms at a little dinky, the Algonquin Hotel, you might remember that.
Yeah.
It was very funky, and it was in a big ballroom with chairs all around the perimeter. And then one little stage there. And so I went to that and met people there, and they went to a restaurant for a thing, and then they told me about the Rationalist Society, so I went to another meeting, and there was the MC for that evening was a former circus performer who could hold 4 golf balls in his mouth and demonstrated it. You know, I said, so this is atheism. And he mentioned a paper called The Independent, and I went and got to the office of the Independent and met Lyle Stewart, who was the biggest influence in my life. He, too, was an atheist, and he edited a paper that was the forerunner of the alternative press. And I started out stuffing envelopes there then became the managing editor. And out of that developed The Realist, which was essentially the banner logo on the front was a free thought, criticism, and satire. So it started out with that, and the first subscriber was Steve Allen, who bought several subscriptions for others, and then one of whom was Lenny Bruce, and Lenny sent out subscriptions to a lot of people. It was so it grew in a Malthusian way, and Lenny became the other big influence in my life as a satirist, and I ended up editing his autobiography. So in answer to your question, that there was this chain of events that I label as random destiny.
All right. You know, and I have to tell you, Paul, when I was a kid, I was reading The Realist because there was only one kid in my neighborhood, Lenny Dicardi, and his parents they gave him permission to actually get that all the time, and he would share it with me, and we used to sit in his basement and read that, and it was incredible, including there were some that just you'd left you sitting there with your mouth open. You know, and it was just so mind-blowing just to read it. So I wanted to thank you for that. Yeah, it's really...
No, you know, you just painted a beautiful picture. I can picture it, almost like a Norman Rockwell.
Yeah, exactly.
But through the basement window, you can see a gang of nuns rushing at you.
Right. You got it, exactly. Oh, you had to bring those nuns up again. Now, Stephanie, one more question for you. You had, and I have to say, when you mentioned Jennifer McCrate, her gift for the godless is priceless, and I won't say anything more about it, but people really have to check this out. And I would say something I want to read before we go, but I want to ask you one question, is one of my favorite essays in here is the one by Brian Cox, which I think is very similar to what you were talking about, but I just found there's a whole part of the end that really I think is really good. I wanted to ask you this. The idea that you brought together such a wide array of people from Paul, who actually, I mean, as we're talking about, it's very humorous. There's a lot of satire involved in his, and there's a lot of truth telling. You also bring physicists, you bring scientists into it, you bring political forces into it, you bring comedians into it. You know, how did you, that kind of vision, what kind of response have you gotten to it? How did you actually bring these people together or develop that kind of vision to have that breadth of view? And then what's the response been?
You know, I have to give a lot of credit to Robin, who is my co-editor, who did a lot, almost more of the legwork than I did. But really, once people found out about it, a lot of people wanted to be involved. And word sort of spread through the atheist/skeptic community, and we were contacted by people who wanted to volunteer as well. So it was maybe much easier than it looked, because so many people from so many different areas of expertise, once they heard about it, really wanted to join in.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Paul, Stephanie, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Oh, it was delightful. Anytime.
And we'll have you back. Okay, take care now. Great. And happy holidays.
One thing, Michael. God bless you.
Okay, you did it again. There are those nuns charging through the door. Thanks, Paul. Okay. See you later now. Talk to you later.
All right, well, we've run out of time, so we got to be real quick. I want to thank everybody who was involved in the production of this and everybody who's listening. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
The silvery sound of sleigh bells, the rap of reindeer hoofs, a man all clothed in crimson, he runs from roof to roof. He clambers down the chimneys, leaves toys neath all the trees, till everyone home, the lights click on, and someone yells out, freeze, Santa Stewart.